The initial conception of blackness developed here. There's always been a conception of blackness, I suppose, since Negroes arrived in this country. But the conception of blackness as being a positive thing, as an extraordinarily beautiful thing, an extraordinarily unique thing, develops in the Renaissance.
This is Andromeda 21, a series of conversations, rap sessions, with speakers from the 1971 Afro-American Culture Lecture Series held on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. The purpose of these programs is to inform and inspire, to spread the realization that black is beautiful. The title of this program refers to the Ethiopian princess Andromeda, who, like us, was in chains, became free, and later took her place among the stars.
I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I know.
Amanda, you than the goose again.
This is one of the most exciting sounds of the Harlem Renaissance. The more you listen to it, the more it grows on you. The Harlem Renaissance is that period of Afro-American history that I'll be discussing today with Dr. Charles Davis, professor of English and chairman of the Afro-American Studies Committee at the University of Iowa.
If I would let historians guide me, the word Renaissance would bring into my mind the flower and the glory and the volcanic intensity of Italy of several centuries ago. Or if I'd let them tell me that it's for the 20th century they're using the term Renaissance, I couldn't help but think about figures such as Hemingway or Fitzgerald or Cummings or Anderson, and I would let this traditional clan of historians lead me astray. I wouldn't, in all probability, hear names like Tuma or Hughes or Fisher or James Weldon Johnson or Hurston or Thurman, and this is why it's such a delight to have you today to tell us about the Harlem Renaissance.
I expect that it was Professor Alan Locke of the of Howard University who coined the term. And actually, it's very precise, because the word Renaissance means, finally, rebirth. And though you were thinking, say, of the Tuscan hills and other pleasant places in Italy, actually the use of that term Renaissance in Italy was for the rebirth of classical culture.
Wow.
And this instance, the rebirth has to do with folk roots. It has to do with the folk arts, with the revival of a relationship with Africa, things of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, sometimes, though you've put it very eloquently, regional associations with the site of the Renaissance may mislead us a little bit.
What were the basic purposes of the Harlem Renaissance? In a way, you've sort of anticipated that, but could
yes.
you elaborate further on that?
I think there was a kind of general purpose, and that is to encourage writing, to encourage arts. And in one way, this is the first explosive flowering, if I can mix metaphors, first explosive development of black art, in which there was not a single black writer or a single black poet, but a lot of them publishing simultaneously. And this had not happened before. So that happened. In doing so, however, Locke was shrewd enough, and people felt that it was necessary to do it anyway, to see what was necessary is to probe one's history, to find out about one's roots, what life was in the South, what is the nature of the relationship with Africa, what is unique about black culture, what is the contribution of the blues, of jazz, of the folk narratives, of the folk art sermon. These are the things that intrigued them. And it developed into a notion, obviously, that from these roots, and with the kind of modern form which was given to them by Toomer and Hughes and Walron and McKay and others, there was a unique contribution that could be made by black civilization, by black culture, one that America badly needed at that particular time.
It seems that you're describing a very, very important quest for identity.
Yes, indeed.
And so if there is an important quest at this time, it means that a vacuum must have existed
exactly.
Before them.
There was a vacuum. As a matter of fact, I suppose there are things worse than a vacuum. Because before that time, American Negroes felt as if they were very much under attack. During the period, especially of the years immediately after World War I, that attack had been stepped up a great deal. This was the time in which the great expectations that some blacks had associated with World War I and its achievement, its termination, these were frustrated. And this was the time for the revival of the Ku Klux Klan. And so, in a sense, it's not simply a vacuum, it's a negative image that dominated, obviously, the minds of many Americans. And so there is a rhetorical advantage in projecting a renaissance at this time.
Very exciting metaphor, I'd
good.
Say. So could you tell us, you've listed a few already, but could you mention perhaps the major figures as you see them in the Renaissance?
First of all, there would be the organizer, the impresario, the philosopher of the Renaissance, who was not really essentially a creative man himself. And this is Alan Locke, but whose letters to Toomer, to Hughes, and Cullen encouraged these young men to write. And he offered them criticism. He made contacts with publishers. Some people have spoken derogatory of this particular kind of activity of Locke, calling him a kind of mother hen, for example. But someone has to be the mother hen of every movement, and Locke was there. You should begin with Alan Locke. Now, the creative talents of the Renaissance are very diverse, really. Toomer, McKay, Hughes, Walron, Fisher, all very different people. Toomer, for example, a young man, scarcely, hardly black, just barely black, but becoming an artist by assuming his blackness. And in this way, producing perhaps the most spectacular work of the Renaissance, that amazing novel, the innovative achievement, which is called Cain. Hughes, perhaps more beautifully than anyone else, exploring his folk roots in the blues, in jazz, picking up the nuances of everyday talk. All very different. Rudolph Fisher, a sophisticated New Yorker, a doctor, leading very much a worldly life, but being enchanted by the speech he heard around him, the predecessor of what we call today hip talk or swing talk.
So we're talking about an area above Central Park from 125th to 140th, I believe.
Precisely. And it's good to know just where that is, because obviously Harlem now stretches from 110th Street indefinitely. I mean, it goes up, obviously, up to 160. But in those days, I have heard people talk about it. 125th Street was the dividing line. And one might even call it the battle line between what was Harlem and what was not Harlem.
Okay, I was going to say then the period of time we're talking about is roughly the 20s.
Now, the 20s. I would begin it, if it's always very difficult to begin a movement, and you never date a movement from its manifesto. Because obviously, by the time someone gets around to recognizing it, it's already been going on for some time. And I would date it, actually, from the early 1920s, and I like to think of its beginning with Shuffle Along.
Well, let's begin with, even before that, with the 1913 Armory Show.
The 1913 Armory Show had, of course, a tremendous impact upon American art. It brought American painting of age. And after that, it seems to me, American painting especially, and American sculpture and other American arts, had to reckon with the full impact of European experimentation. Now, so far as the Harlem Renaissance is concerned, what was important about that show was the fact that it introduced America to African art. And the notion that African art had been a prime source for new departures for such great artists as Modigliani and Picasso and Zatkin and others, suggested itself, that notion suggested itself to Locke and to others, that there is a very rewarding result to come from renewing the connection with Africa. It's a very interesting point because in some ways there was very little knowledge, direct knowledge of Africa. And so, though Africa is extremely important in the Harlem Renaissance, it was an artistic conception of Africa more related to the Armory Show than any kind of specific knowledge of the coast of West Africa.
I see. Let's go up now to 1921 with the musical Shuffle Along, which appeared at the 63rd Street Theater in New York.
Precisely.
Noble Sissel and Blake, among others.
That's right.
So what was it, and then what was its impact on Harlem?
It would be difficult to speak too highly of its impact. It exploded. This musical, an all-black musical, with a new music for most Americans.
The way you described it last night so vividly, I could hear the music and I could smell the smells and see the sights.
That's right. That's right.
Very exciting.
And see these talents that were new for most Americans. The dancing, the singing, the jazz, all combined to make this review a remarkable thing.
Menda, chocolate color Dixie May. Sweet Miss Menda, let me enda, meet the grander moon. Oh, come along, Menda, listen to my serenade.
This happened, and this was the amazing show. This attracted people to these remarkable talents in the black part of New York. And this brought people streaming to Harlem from downtown. This encouraged, obviously, the nightclubs, boosted the business at the Cotton Club, made it possible for more and more people to come to those little clubs, little smoky clubs in Harlem, where great musicians like Fats Waller and others were playing at this time.
Shuffle Along had an exceptionally long run.
It did indeed.
Can you tell us how long that was?
My memory is that it lasted for several seasons.
I see.
But it's very hard to say, and I don't really remember actually how long Shuffle Along went. In a sense, it was succeeded by others that came along behind it, using often the same talent that originally appeared in Shuffle Along. So we have a kind of continuous Shuffle Along all through the 1920s with different titles.
Very interesting double entendre there. Let's go up to 1922 with the publication of Harlem Shadows by Claude McKay.
Yes.
And could you try to describe its impact now on the movement?
Yes, indeed. McKay precedes the Renaissance. He had a kind of experience since he came from the West Indies, since he was born in Jamaica. He had a kind of experience which was new in many ways to American audiences. And he could look, too, at his coming to Harlem in a new and fresh way. And this kind of originality suggested that this West Indian infusion would be very important in the Renaissance, calling attention that there was a culture in the West Indies that in some ways is preferable to the kind of technological culture that was being developed in New York. It called attention that in the memories of the West Indies, in the memories of a more pastoral life, in the memories of the hills and the skies and the fruit of the West Indies, it called attention to that a softer and more harmonious existence that for someone in New York seemed to be much preferable, perhaps, to the kind of hectic pace of life there. Harlem Shadows established the, it seems to me, the suggested at least, the first of a whole long line of works that are variations on the pastoral, variations on the quest for a more ideal existence. There is much of that, for example, in Tuma, who was awakened by the traumatic experience of returning to Georgia. But in this particular instance, it's McKay's imagination going back to recapture his youth. At the same time, he looks at the Harlem experience from the point of view of someone, often from the point of view of someone barely civilized, and to comment upon it there.
Yeah, this is that motif which you call primitive strength, I believe.
That's right. And then the other thing about McKay, who's extremely complicated, is that he was a radical. I mean, he was a good friend of Max Eastman's. He was a contributor to the old Liberator. And there we find in him and the kind of eloquence in his protest poetry, which is rare and quite wonderful. So eloquent, indeed, that Winston Churchill quoted him in the poem, If We Must Die. So we have this interesting combination of elements in McKay.
I see. By the time we get to 1924, another very significant event occurs, which is a dinner. And could you mention that?
Yes, indeed. But the fact of the matter is that this was a dinner which was organized, or initially suggested by Charles Johnson, who was then editor of Opportunity Magazine, who wrote a letter to Locke and said, wouldn't it be good for us to have a dinner in honor especially of Jesse Fawcett, who was publishing There Is Confusion. And Jesse Fawcett was considered one of the young budding talents. But really, it was not so much for Fawcett as it was for all of the new young talents just emerging. And coming to the dinner were not only people who were interested the emerging black art, but people who were interested in doing something about the black artists, publishers, writers for magazines like the Survey Graphic. And so this was an occasion, actually, to launch in a very official way the interest in black art, and it provided the opportunity for connections that would lead to publication.
So by the time we get to 1925, the next year, we actually do have a manifesto.
We do have a manifesto,
and
that's
what
right.
Was that manifesto then?
It would be Locke's introduction to, first of all, to these writers in the Survey Graphic, the issue which was turned over to Alan Locke. And then this became a book published by Boney and Liveright. And the book was called then The New Negro. And it was a very handsome and impressive book with beautiful ornaments and devices and marvelous pictures and illustrations, so that this is how it became officially launched here in 1925.
Yeah, also in 25 appeared the book the Book of American Negro Spirituals, edited by James Weldon Johnson.
Exactly.
And in that, you indicated that he said spirituals were a significant contribution to American culture.
Right.
So my question once more is, what was the view of them before then?
Before that...
So let's make it, if we can make this distinction.
All right, good.
The view of spirituals first by black people,
yes,
and then by white people, if that distinction is valid.
Now, the spirituals were not quite in the category of jazz. But on the other hand, spirituals were not considered high art. In America, which is, of course, a highly mobile and society, the distinctions between high art and low art have always been very, very carefully drawn. And it true, people had heard and enjoyed the spirituals through the 19th century. But very few attempts had been made outside of Hampton and Tuskegee to collect them. Spirituals in general had not been used in the as the substance of the raw matter for more ambitious compositions, musical compositions. And it was not until the 1920s that it was recognized as being very serious music, very important music, and as one of the few native contributions that America had made to music. And so this realization is something that came belatedly, it is true, at that time. And that's the significance of James Weldon Johnson's the book of American Negro Spirituals.
Yeah, the thing that hits me very much here is that until a people realizes its own identity, it can't even determine what's important in its lifestyle.
Exactly. The initial conception of blackness developed here. There's always been a conception of blackness, I suppose, since Negroes arrived in this country. But the conception of blackness as being a positive thing, as an extraordinarily beautiful thing, an extraordinarily unique thing, develops in the Renaissance.
I see. Now, what about some of the major themes of the Harlem Renaissance? You indicated that there is an affinity in terms of theme with the mainstream of American writers as opposed to an affinity with form. So could you list some of the themes that...
I'd be glad to. One of the themes, of course, is this version of the pastoral I talked about earlier. This deep dissatisfaction with modern scientific and technological culture. This insistence that in order for us to live wholly and completely, we have to renew our roots. We have to connect once again with the soil. We have to tie ourselves to traditions that come out of the soil. We have to base our art on the agrarian way of life. Now, this emerges obviously most brilliantly in Toomer's Cain. But as I pointed out last evening, this expression of the theme is to be discovered really in some form in Sherwood Anderson, in Ernest Hemingway, and in others. But the particular form, the particular kind of validation of that experience could come out of the life of black people in America, because they indeed had lived close to the soil from the 17th century on. And in a sense, this had been a most rewarding experience artistically from them, because from this had come the spirituals, had come the folk art sermon, had come the folk narratives, all of these various rich forms of native art. I'm not saying that these things justified, obviously, the institution of slavery or the justified the kind of deprivation that occurred in the South and perhaps in some ways still occurs. But what these writers discovered is that as a consequence of that experience, something rich did develop. And this was something that modern blacks and would like to ignore or to forget. And modern whites knew nothing about. And it emerged here with great brilliance, obviously, in Toomer's Cain.
Yeah, Sherwood Anderson mentioned that the only joy in America was found in white folks' kitchens.
That's right.
Now, is this a stereotype or is there any validity in that statement?
There is. The difficulty with a statement like that is that, you know, it's true in both ways.
Some say that black folks are the happiest people with nothing than anybody.
Which, of course, is not true at all. On the other hand, if you believe, as these writers believed, that the culture lived close to the soil was emotionally fuller, then, in a sense, you are saying that the people who keep alive their roots in the soil are happier, live a fuller, better adjusted life than others. Now, that is a form of the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that we should be mistaken if we simply dismissed it.
It seems to me
another
that
form of,
too often we're dismissing stereotypes universally, where some of them seem to apply. So, for example, there was a time when we resented the stereotype of our being naturally rhythmic.
Exactly.
Now we think honorific.
Precisely. This, of course, is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. And that, of course, is a stereotype, too, that most blacks felt offended by for many years.
Right.
Now, the Harlem Renaissance sought to reverse all of that. They sought to take these qualities that they thought that blacks genuinely possessed and say that these are marvelous and unique characteristics upon which we can base a unique contribution to American culture.
Like any Renaissance, it seems that the Harlem one also had its decline and fall.
Yes.
So what factors led to the decline of the Harlem Renaissance?
It would be easy to say that it was the Depression that killed it. And it took obviously 2 or 3 years after 1929 for it to be killed. But by 1932, it seemed to me that the very little of the Renaissance left. It doesn't mean that there weren't vestiges still. Zora Neale Hurston, for example, continues to write using much of the mythology of the Renaissance on into the 1930s and even into the 40s. But many of the figures of the Renaissance itself ceased writing. Some of them who continued to write changed their style and changed their themes. Langston Hughes, for example, who became more and more interested in proletarian themes. And Cullen, for example, not writing any longer about the themes of the Renaissance, but becoming more and more interested in purely literary projects, like doing a version of the Medea. So it ceased for a variety of reasons. The intellectual atmosphere changed profoundly. The gay Harlem disappeared. The nightclubs went bankrupt. Much of the music was gone, though obviously the music still existed in such local institutions as the storefront churches and things of that kind, and that never really died. But people stopped going to Harlem. Harlem ceased to be gay, and the Depression made Harlem a grim nightmare rather than the gay exotic place that you find, say, in the pages of Fitzgerald and other writers of the time.
And you indicated that today, too, the nightmare and the dream exist side by side.
Side by side, the nightmare and the dream. You get the best sense of that in Hughes, in which you get the affection and the hate tied together. The nightmare became intensified, of course, in the 1950s with the coming of drugs to Harlem, which is described memorably, obviously, in Claude Brown's book, Man-Child and the Promised Land. But the dream, obviously, is there, too, and it seems to me, in our own time, they do exist side by side. Harlem never recovered, even when the Depression left. The money never flowed back in Harlem. Harlem never recovered, really, after World War II, when one expected that affluence would return to it. And so that presents, I think, one of the problems, obviously, that one has to face when one lives in Harlem and one writes about Harlem.
I've been discussing the Harlem Renaissance with Dr. Charles Davis, professor of English and chairman of the Afro-American Studies Committee at the University of Iowa. Next week on this program, my guest will be Lou Palmer, Chicago radio commentator, reporter, and editor for the Chicago Daily News.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me.
This has been Andromeda 21, another in the series of conversations with speakers from the 1971 Afro-American Culture Lecture Series held on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. Your host for this series is Hank Parker, instructor in the Department of Classics at the University of Illinois.
All the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. To be me, then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
Andromeda 21 was produced and directed by Louise Geislers for WILL, the the radio service of the University of Illinois in Urbana.